Good evening.
Good evening.
Nice to see you, Edith. Wish you all a happy new year. Hard to believe we've come to this point again. We seem to do it every single year. I keep thinking of Pureg because I spent a number of New Year sessions at Pureg in the snow. So we would sit in the dark zendo and the snow would be piling up in the windows higher and higher. And then on New Year's Eve we would sit until midnight and then ring the bell, the big bell actually, it's a big log that you swing that's hanging on a rope and you swing it against this huge bell. Bong! 108 times. And then climb up to where they've been building a bonfire for the whole week. Work period is making a bonfire, so it's as tall as we are. And light the fire, and then it's just blazing up in the middle of the snow, and the snow is falling down. Great way to spend New Year. So they're doing it now. We can think of them. They're doing it at Felsentor also, and many, many other places. Sitting in the new year.
Well, Chakotay has a New Year's Eve sit too.
Do they do that?
Yes. I don't think the bonfire, no. And no snow.
Not yet.
Well, no,
anyway.
They do have a fire. They said in their announcement, they said something about burning your regrets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably outdoors, but not probably a big bonfire.
Right. Not the right place or time for that. Arcata, they do it, and they have. They all during the year put the name of people who have passed away or who are sick on the altar and then take them down and save them and then take all the little leftover pieces of incense that end up in the ash and burn it all together. Let it just go up and disappear. It's good to note, in a way. It's another kind of formality. It's a little bit like reciting the Heart Sutra and walking in Kinhin and just creating a coherence in a rather incoherent kind of life. It's very helpful. So I think we are on number 8, which is direction and goal in this book, in which Uchiyama Roshi is talking about how to live the middle way. It's really interesting right now. The listserv for the American Zen teachers is a long conversation among some of the oldest teachers, the ones who've been around for a long time, about how we do transmission and how we recognize enlightenment in our students. And everybody has a different take on it, a different tradition. They inherited a tradition from their teachers in Korea and Japan and China, but then it's changed in America, so everybody has not only their original teaching, but then the new way of doing it, and then somebody sent an article about a new place in New York City where it's a very slick, very beautiful, gorgeous place with soft music playing as a zendo, and they have a foyer in which that you can buy cups with Bodhidharma on it and all kinds of chatkas that you can pick up, and they will teach you yoga or zazen or mindfulness or in this gorgeous way. You get to, online, you can reserve a cushion, your own cushion in the little setup that they have. It's, and there's an argument, is this the way to do it? Is this right? Some people say, oh yes, this is what we've been trying to do, to bring young people in and make it interesting. And other people are saying, oh, you've got to be kidding. Is this the way to do it? So, reading Uchiyama is really fascinating to think about it in real life terms. Adam Tevi also asked us, also in Facebook, he sent a little note to all the Zen teachers, and he said, what are the three most important problems that we need to face in this next year? Mm-hmm. Some people wrote long, long essays about all these things that we need to do and all the problems that we have, the financial problems and all of these, and other people just said, I'm afraid I was one of ones who said, we don't know what's going to happen. We really can't tell. I truly believe none of us knows, including the President of the United States or anybody else. We try our best. We do our best. We're all intelligent. Human beings are intelligent beings, but there's so much of us that is carried through life that our projections are simply projections. And I do truly trust our life itself. I think we can trust our life completely. It's what it is. It's what we are. But to go beyond that trust, I think, is extra and often brings disappointment. It means that many, many times we really don't know what the answer is until it's already happened. And often that's a mercy. It's really better not to know. So he talks about how whether this practice is a religion or not, and that's in part of the discussion also. Some people think that this is a religion that we're practicing, and some think it's practice. Kogan always said zazen itself is zazen, and on those experiences that we have, that we can and have created many different kinds of religion. Some very strict and full of rules, and some full of loving kindness and service. We've inherited a tremendous amount of teaching. I've been looking in Dogen, looking up things and seeing what an immense amount of talk goes into Shobo Genzo about practice, saying the same thing over and over and over again. I think sometimes it's a religion, and mostly it's a way of life. We come to sit. It's lovely to be able to come and sit with each other. But we have a life in which we infuse our breath itself with our practice and our understanding of Buddha's teaching. Be your light, be your own light. So he says it's only natural that faith is going to appear with teachings about hell and heaven and bad and good and happiness. And he said faith in Buddhism is the ability to recognize happiness and unhappiness, heaven and hell, all with the same eye, and to live out the life of one's total self despite the circumstances that arise. Says this is an area which does not quite fit into expectations of man's egocentric desires. We'd like to choose the good side and the happy side and the beneficial side, but I always think when somebody brings up one side that we have to say, and yet, there's always another side. That was Nagarjuna's teaching too. Bring up this, but inevitably this side exists. It's how our mind works. So he quotes the Shushoji, which is a compilation of somebody made in Japan many years after Dogen of his so-called best little paragraphs, just cobbled them all together and made it an extra little thing that people in Zen monasteries recite sometimes every day, the Shushoji. He quotes it as this: since everything is impermanent, there is nothing that can be relied upon. Like a dewdrop on a blade of grass along the path that vanishes quickly, who knows when this life will end? This body is surely not my possession. Life changing in time does not stop even for an instant. And Uchiyama Roshi says this second passage follows somewhat later. Ultimately, the law of cause and effect operates clearly and impartially apart from my will. Without exception, one who commits evil actions falls, while one who performs good prospers. And Uchiyama Roshi says these two statements are completely contradictory. The first is about impermanence, everything continually changing, which means nothing, neither wealth, health, nor children can be accumulated. Can't keep any of it. He says if you have these accumulations as a goal, you'll eventually be disappointed. The second statement introduces the world of cause and effect. A good cause will yield a good result, and a bad cause will yield a bad one. The result of one action influences the next. How do we make sense out of this? And then he talks, gives a little story about somebody who lives a sort of thoughtless life and goes out and tries to make a lot of money, and he makes a lot of mistakes, and he comes to grief and ends up committing suicide. He said, This is a person who constructed his view of life mistakenly thinking only in terms of impermanence. Concluding that life is short, no one knows when they're going to die, he became desperate, and just then the law of cause and effect came to the forefront. The man who sees only in terms of cause and effect, who thinks that what life is all about is the acquisition of money and health and devotes his life to that, may die in an instant in a traffic accident. So, when we run into examples, he says, of this kind of lifestyle, we certainly can become confused as to just how we should live out our lives. He said, the view which only sees living in the world as impermanent and our trying to accumulate anything as useless is referred to as Dankan, whereas a way of life which assumes that things must be accumulated and is based solely on setting up the limited goals of wealth, etc., is called Jokin. Both of these views are understood to be one-sided. This understanding brought about the exposition of the middle way. It doesn't mean halfway. Rather, it means to accept this contradiction of impermanence and cause and effect within your own life. To accept it means to forbear and overcome it without trying to resolve it. That's the tricky part. We always try to fix it into place. It feels more secure that way. It's very hard to accept our insecurity. And yet our freedom lies in our insecurity. At its very essence, life is contradiction, and the flexibility to forbear and assimilate contradiction without being beaten down by it nor attempting to resolve it is our life force. This is our life. So it means in daily life to live without projecting goals while yet having a direction. And that's the essential message of this little chapter. Without projecting goals and yet having a sense of direction. In the Tenzo Kyokun, he says, we must prepare for the next morning, the night before. We know there are going to be hungry people and we have to get the food ready. We have to clean up the kitchen and get it all set to go. But we don't really know what exactly is going to happen the next day. It might be very different. The water main might break. The stove may not work. We've had many adventures in Jikoji and Sesshin when things went terribly awry that we couldn't possibly imagine. And yet we have to be ready for what we project as our job at the moment and not be horrified when things go another way. Because that going another way is life itself. It's just the way it is. He said, there's an extremely vital teacher to be found in this little statement about deciding on the amount of food and the number of side dishes for the morning and the Tenzo consulting with other officers. Uchiyama Roshi says, in this world of impermanence, we have no idea what may occur during the night. Maybe there'll be an earthquake or a disastrous fire. War may break out, or perhaps a revolution might erupt, or we ourselves could very well meet death. So we've got the kitchen all cleaned up, and then we keel over.
At least your chores were finished.
But we prepare the gruel and make a plan for lunch and enjoy it. And it's tonight's work, as he points out. We're just doing tonight's work. So there's no goal for tomorrow. It's just doing tonight what we need to do tonight, because that's how things work. So he says this routine matter of preparing tomorrow's gruel as this evening's work lies the key to the attitude necessary for coping with this absolute contradiction of impermanence and cause and effect. He said, when we stop projecting goals and hopes in the future and refuse to be led around by them, yet work to clarify our lives, that is the direction of the present, this moment, then we will discover an alive and dynamic practice. At this juncture of this contradiction, we'll begin to understand the function of the tenso. So it's also pointing out how important it is to examine our direction, to really know how we are comporting ourselves. In practice also, I think it's really important. Gil wrote an article in Shambhala magazine about really addressing our practice and noting what it is that we're doing and why, what kind of direction that we have in our life about living like this, living this life. This life of how we do, how we act and enact what comes to us to do. Are we willing it? Do we have, some people have a goal when they come to sit. They're going to get enlightened. One of the teachers in the lift served said he went to Katagiri Roshi, and he had had an experience in Zazen that really blew his mind. And he told his teacher, and his teacher said, yes, that's very good. And he said, you know, the bushes out along the driveway have overgrown and they're scraping the cars. Could you cut them back? So it's not a goal. Our goal is this right now, right here, is being fulfilled right this very minute in a wonderful way. Every moment. So there's time for discussion. Jennifer?
It reminds me, when I was in college in my philosophy class, we were talking about is life a dream or is this a simulation or whatever, and the conversation ended with it doesn't matter because we still have act as if today is real.
Yeah.
Like, you're still reacting to things I say, so even if it is a dream,
yeah,
doesn't matter.
Yeah, have to get up in the morning, brush our teeth. Yeah. But it does matter how we, our attitude to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, like, that was kind of how the discussion went, was that it, in the immediate sense, it doesn't matter if it's a dream or not. In the long-term sense, you still have to be a decent human being.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested that you talked about, you brought up the issue of whether Buddhism is a secular experience or religious. And it seems like there's a middle ground, that it is middle ways, it's a practice. But I came across two poignant points that it in favor of religion. And one was that if you define religion as transformative, it is that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was a line from Kenneth Roshi, who said, and I'm paraphrasing her poorly, that you have to have faith in your practice or in your experience, because without it, it's not quite, you know, there.
Yes.
And I'm paraphrasing her poorly, but so I think there's a little of both, and I was wondering how you felt about it.
I completely agree with I, in fact, that's what I was in my reply to Adam Tebbe, that we have to trust it and have faith in the practice itself and in the teaching, because we don't know. And yet, in that sense, it is a spiritual practice. It's allowing ourselves to actually submit to life rather than whip it into shape, in our shape, to be informed by it, as well as having some kind of ability to go with it as we do. It's really quite mysterious. Yeah. So in that sense, in a devotional sense, even, it's a religion. And I think we carry both as we sit. I mean, we bow to the cushion before we sit on it. And I think if we really feel true gratitude for the chair that's holding us up, it's a devotional thing. Yeah.
I don't know of any other way to learn these truths. Science doesn't do it. Psychology only grips the surface, maybe it's deep.
Yes.
And as far as that goes, it's a practice. For me, it's a habit. It's been so long.
Yes.
But it still takes work. It's not automatic. It requires intention and precision.
And precision, exactly. Yes.
Courage,
yes, indeed.
Perseverance.
Yes, yes.
It's not a, well, it is an e-ticket ride for those people who know what e-tickets are, because there's nothing like it.
There's nothing like it. There is nothing like it. Somebody, in that article, they quoted somebody who went to the slick, fancy Upper East Side New York New Zendo, and came out saying, well, I don't know, nothing happened, but I feel like I had a massage. Well, it's a strange year that we're heading into, and this whole teaching about impermanence and cause and effect and all of that. It's, some people say, oh, it's a dark time, but it's always been a dark time, as long as I can remember, and I've lived a long time. And I've read a lot of history, and oh, man, it's just, it's always like this. And we're always surprised. Oh my goodness. Where did that come from? Who knows? Who knows? So I wish us all a lot of luck and many blessings. Probably Brother David Stendhal Rost has the best idea. Just keep developing gratitude. Just be thankful. Look at us. Aren't we lucky? Incredible. So are there announcements? Our Eno isn't here. Imam is coming. Is it next Wednesday or this, or the one after? Does anybody remember?
Imam?
The Muslim
teacher.
It's a January.
Well, next Wednesday is January. So it's next week.
Oh, okay.
It's here on Wednesday night. Mm-hmm.
That's what I recall.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Jeff.
No, put it in the calendar I'm working on.
Oh, good. Good. I hope people come. I'm very eager for people to be here. The Insight Group are sponsoring it, and they've invited the Insight people. So they said they'd provide for lots of ways to sit down, so it won't be uncomfortable. But I hope a lot of people.
I won't be able to make next Tuesday. I'm making a presentation about a veterans group.
Oh, good for you.
My veterans, right?
Yes.
And which has unfolded in ways that I could have never imagined. But so I will be here Wednesday for the imam.
Yeah. Tell people what you do.
There's three of us who are facilitators for veterans, men and women. We've had them as young as 18 up to 93. We actually had a World War II veteran come. And it's discussion and writing. And very much like any poetry group that has writing prompts, we usually have a writing prompt that that we send out before the month, and then so when they arrive, they can choose to read it or not to read it, and then we discuss what they've been writing about. Of course, that is a launch for quite the conversation and for a great deal of. It opens a door to a lot of things for people, and it certainly has opened up a door for me, which I had no idea how many doors there are in that whole discussion. So you know, this is where certainly my Zen practice, my sitting practice, how it dovetails into listening to people talk about at times very dark things, a lot of kind of catch-22 things. There's something quite bizarre sometimes that occurs when you're in the military. Just bizarre stuff.
Yeah.
And but it's it's been unfolding in stages, and it's been just great. The facilitators, or the people that are involved in the program, it's been very warmly received, and we keep getting invited to different kinds of groups to make our presentations, and every time we do, a couple of people jump on board.
Yay.
So, yeah.
That's super.
And then it's about how you connect with... See, you read about things in the New York Times, or you read about things in our paper about struggling veterans or the issues that a vet may have, and then you meet them face to face, and you start having a visceral and a heart-to-heart connection with them, and it just really switches the dynamic of what we're talking about. So now we've got, you know, the faces to people, the names to people. Stories take on an entirely different quality.
Yeah.
So it's really been a blessing.
So glad you're doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's connecting you with some things that I think I sort of kept at a distance. Because I knew it was going to be, one aspect of it was going to be extremely dark. And, it was that time in my practice when I felt I was ready for that step. Mm-hmm. So, I'm very grateful I've done this and look forward to continuing it.
Super. Thank you.
So, Angie, you're going to be here tomorrow night with the Insight Group?
Oh, yes, I will.
Will you be talking about anything in particular?
I don't know yet. I never know until...
Whatever comes up.
Whatever comes up, right.
And then our first Saturday sit at the... 2016 will be on January 9th, and it's a half day. And I'll be getting the calendar for the year out probably this weekend.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you, Wendy.
That's a big help. That's a huge help. Well, should we do our 1 minute sit?
Okay.